All right, let's begin the reading of today's Boston Herald on the Talking Information Center for today, Friday, the 21st of August, 2026. You're listening to the Talking Information Center, and we say hello to Bob and Dottie.
Thank you, John. And read our first front page story from today's Herald. "I am a mother, a survivor," that's in quotes, "hundreds demonstrate outside Lindsay Clancy trial." And this is by Grace Sokovich. "A sea of supporters in pink stood for Lindsay Clancy outside the Plymouth courthouse yesterday morning, sharing stories of postpartum experiences and a collective moment of silence in support of the defendant. I don't know if you'll ever have this many women in one place at one time that understand all of us at a level that others don't," organizer Renee Kimball told throngs of supporters gathered in a ring just before the trial started. "So it may be a good time to take the time to say hello to people, give hugs, and show your support for them too. We've all shown up here for Lindsay and for women across the world." The Stand in Peace for Lindsay demonstration gathered outside Plymouth Superior Court by 7:45 a.m. The supporters dressed in pink, donning messages like "they failed her" and "she's not alone," and lined up alongside the roads as law enforcement vehicles drove up to the courthouse. The attendees held a moment of silence in a circle around 8:30 a.m. before holding a collective prayer for the defendant and her family. Flyers for the gathering encouraged supporters not to protest, rally, shout, or make signs stating, "Our silence is our support." Supporters came from far and near, and from an early morning 7-hour drive from Pennsylvania to a flight from Nevada the day before to a group of local nurses who came after work. "I'm here because I am a mother, and I am a survivor," said Rhonda Parker, who flew in from Las Vegas. "I'm here to support all of the women that can't be here, and so Lindsay no longer stands alone like she has for the past 3 years." Learning about the case, Parker said, she connected to the feeling of being a mother, being alone, having thoughts that you can't say, adding, "mental health is not something that's normalized whatsoever." Many of those in attendance brought their own stories of mental health crises of their own or loved ones, with individuals in the crowd hugging and sharing with each other after the moment of silence. "We last year lost my brother to suicide," said Marissa Kent Kimball, a local Carver resident not related to Renee Kimball, her words slowing as she spoke about her family's story. "That definitely is a component. Just because so many people suffer and just keep it to themselves, or they try to get the help they need, and just..." Lindsay was trying, her mom Angela Campbell finished. The Kimballs encouraged people to look out for those around who may be going through something or suffering, saying, "be there, check in, hold their hand, help advocate for them, because sometimes you can't always advocate for yourself." Mental health care is a system that is so fractured, and sadly, people don't always get the help they deserve, and people don't recognize it, Marissa said, adding, "they're hopeful Clancy gets help, and talking about it helps more people." Renee Kimball, who came down from Maine to organize yesterday's gathering, said the day the Clancy children's autopsies were read, she could not let it go, and reached out to others, saying, "people were just waiting for an invite." 2 days into this trial, it was very clear that it's become about more than the charges, said Kimball. "And I know that's hard to say because we are here for Cora and Dawson and Callan. We never were not. But it shouldn't take tragedy for people to start paying attention to mental health. And it's clear that if someone had really listened to Lindsay and what she was saying, she wouldn't be here today." Kimball noted the global impact of the case and resonance of issues of postpartum depression and psychosis, as organizers passed out countries' flags intended to represent supporters across the world. "I've had people share their stories," said Kimball. "I just had an amazing young lady come up to me crying. This was so important to her. This is so important to so many people, and I think they've sat with it in silence. And today, give them a way to finally say it aloud." Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. And now, Brothers Bulger, still haunting taxpayers, by Howie Carr. Jailbird Jackie Bulger, who died last week at the age of 88, suffered the worst indignity that can ever befall a member of the Bulger clan. He was stripped of his kiss in the mail, bad enough that the runt of the litter had to go to prison, but that comes with the territory. The worst humiliation for Jailbird Jackie is that while everyone else in his family has been relaxing on the Massachusetts taxpayers' dime for decades now, Bulger lost his $5,326.16 a month pension. Oh, the shame of it. And it was such an injustice. All he did was plead guilty to 2 counts of perjury and 2 counts of obstruction of justice on behalf of his beloved older brother. The serial killing, cocaine dealing, FBI bribing gangster, Whitey Bulger. What happened was, Jackie was the clerk magistrate of the old Boston Juvenile Court when he lied to a federal grand jury. At the time he committed his atrocious crimes, Whitey was on the lam after his own indictment. Jackie contended that his fibs under oath were unrelated to his position as clerk magistrate. The Supreme Judicial Court disagreed, saying, even though his last name was Bulger, he still had an unwavering obligation to tell the truth. Of course, Jailbird Jackie grabbed $300,000 before his pension was pulled. I'm sure he paid back every penny of the ordered restitution. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Jailbird Jackie's paid obituary included a list of his survivors, most of whom collect, or did until their passing, a kiss in the mail from the Commonwealth. Let's start with his surviving brother, the Honorable William M. Bulger, a.k.a. the Corrupt Midget. The former Senate President's annual pension began in 2003 and is now up to $274,539 a year. Jackie is also survived by a daughter, Beth A. Zoda, retired from Senate rules since February, with a pension of $75,968 a year. Her husband, Robert, retired from the MBTA in 2010 at the age of 52, and began collecting an annual pension of $42,822. Jackie's also survived by a son, Mark Bulger. Mark likewise retired from the MBTA back in 2010, when he started pocketing $34,732.44 per annum. He was in his mid-40s when he wrapped up his career in public service. Notice that they both went to work back in the golden age of the MBTA hackorama, when you could put in 20 years at the T and then go out on your full pension. Not for nothing did they call the MBTA Mr. Bulger's Transportation Authority. Am I right, Kevin? 2 weeks? Jackie Bulger is also survived by a sister, Sheila McKeon. She's married to Bill McKeon, who retired from the state's Environmental Police in 2004 and has since been the recipient of an annual pension of $70,663 a year. Jackie was predeceased by his mass murderer brother, Whitey, who did not have a state pension per se. However, until Whitey took it on the lam, was pocketing $119,000 a year from the state after, I quote, winning the mass lottery in 1991. When the feds froze his winnings, his sister Elizabeth Holland sued to get them back. The Bulgers leave nothing on the table, ever. She lost, and until her death in 2019, had to subsist on her own Senate Rules pension of $22,189 a year. Jackie's obituary mentioned that he was the, I quote, longtime loving companion of Rosemary Bailey. Bailey died in 2021 with her devoted companion, Jack Bulger, at her side, according to the death notice. The obit also noted that Jackie's heartthrob worked for many years at the Massachusetts State House. A nationwide search. Jackie was married at one point to a woman named Jean Walsh. After their divorce, she somehow ended up on the payroll at the West Roxbury District Court. She retired in 2002 and has since been collecting $33,917 a year. Do you think Jackie Bulger, in his dotage, ever agonized about any of this? How everyone else in his orbit had retired wealthy through their hack connections, while he was left holding the bag like he was Michael Proctor or somebody. In his early life, Jackie used to work at a fish store in Rosendale Square, but he wanted to be somebody in the old South Boston sense of the word, somebody who didn't have to work. He wanted to be a hack like everybody else in the family. The clerk of the Boston Juvenile Court was another payroll patriot named Paul Heffernan. You don't have to be a lawyer to be a clerk. So it was a sinecure made to order for Jackie. Only problem was they had to get rid of Paul Heffernan. I'm sure Whitey could have handled it. But a different exit was arranged. Heffernan became a judge. His clerkship was open, and Jackie got it. Another nationwide search. Years later, Heffernan's appalling daughter, Mary Beth, got her own judgeship. It was 2013, and she admitted she hadn't even set foot in a courtroom since 1995. But so what? She was Bulger adjacent. And so, farewell then, Jackie Bulger. To his obituary, I would only add a couple of details, one of which would be the Bureau of Prisons, BOP. Number, he was known by during his incarceration. BOP number 23986038. And to predeceased by his brothers James, I would have added Whitey's own BOP number 02182748. You can't tell the Bulgers without their numbers. Bob.
Thank you, Dottie. And our third front page story today, championship caliber, expectations sky high for Pats. And this is another headline, Patriots training camp, fantastic. And this is by Lance Reynolds. Expectations are sky high at Gillette Stadium as the Patriots gear up for the start of their quest to get back to the Super Bowl. Thousands of fans descended upon the practice fields in Foxborough, filling the sideline bleachers and hills. Hundreds flocked to the stadium's ramps, getting a glimpse of their hometown NFL team. Yesterday's joint scrimmage with the Eagles marked the last time that the Patriots will practice in front of their fans this summer, with a home opener a month away. Duke Lally Namola, 12, came out to training camp having just moved back to the Foxborough area after living in Hawaii with his family for the last 8 years. The youngster has lofty expectations for the Patriots this season, predicting they have what it takes to make a deep playoff run. New England lost in demoralizing fashion to the Seahawks last February, 29-13, as the Seattle defense manhandled the Patriots offense. When the two teams meet in a season-opening clash on September 9th in Seattle, the Patriots are expected to look a stronger, more battle-tested squad after an explosive off-season. Lally Namola said the acquisition of A.J. Brown convinced him to attend practice. Facing his former team, the star wide receiver caught two passes, including a red zone touchdown grab. If we get to the playoffs, Lally Namola said, I told the Herald, I think we will make a deep run. I really do. Any team that makes it to the playoffs is a good team, but if we do make it, I think we'll win. John Ho of Newton said he feels really good about the team heading into the season, but he hopes cornerback Christian Gonzalez secures a contract extension sooner than later. Gonzalez, playing under a four-year, $15.1 million rookie contract, just received a fifth-year option for $18.1 million, but he is looking for a bigger, longer-term extension. It's very unique, Ho said, of watching the Patriots square off against the Eagles in practice, because you can actually get the sense of how good they are against actual competition. with the return of football in Foxborough, Gillette Stadium PA announcer Mike Sarge Riley is back to a sense of normalcy. Riley, 41, entering his ninth year as the voice of Gillette, called all seven World Cup matches at Boston Stadium, watching the Globe unite in Foxborough. "There's a lot of excitement here coming off a Super Bowl run," Riley told the Herald. "It's the best way to see your team up close," up close and personal, he said of the joint practice. "You don't have much better access than this." Dorchester resident Dermot Weir drove his 8-year-old son Israel from New Hampshire, where they're vacationing this week with family. Weir said he enjoyed soaking in the practice environment, noting how expensive it can be to get a regular season game. He highlighted how he was a season ticket holder for about 15 years throughout the Tom Brady era, paying about $350 a year at the beginning. The cost, though, skyrocketed to nearly $2,000 a season before he gave them up. Patriots fans are facing an average ticket cost of $605 for the home opener against Pittsburgh on September 20th, almost twice the league-wide average of $386 across all 48 games taking place in September, according to ticket aggregator SeatPick. "I keep trying to explain to him how tough it is to get tickets," Weir said. "As a season ticket holder, you don't just want to give them to anybody. You have to be careful." Kathy Ryan, a Patriots cheerleader in the early 1980s and president of the New England Professional Cheerleaders Alumni Association, said she will always root for the team. "The team's success and level of commitment from everybody on the team is so high," Ryan told the Herald. "Everyone had a fever pitch because we just expect it. I wouldn't want to cheer for any other team. I'm red, white, and blue all the way." Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. And now from the Herald opinion page, the editorial. The Herald endorses Crimmins, Abood, for governor's council. "It can take a village to make a truly bad decision, and few better examples exist than the Massachusetts Parole Board and the nomination-confirming governor's council. The actions of both in championing criminals incarcerated for heinous crimes over their victims has elicited outrage, with each parole release and denial of board candidates who support public safety. Bay Staters have a chance to stand up for victims and our communities by voting for two Republican candidates to represent District 2 and District 7 on the Governor's Council. Francis T. Crimmins, Jr. is running in the Republican primary on September 1st for District 2. As his website states, the former Massachusetts District Court Judge and First Justice is running to bring experience, independent judgment, accountability, and a commitment to public safety to one of the Commonwealth's most important constitutional offices. It should be a logical assumption that Massachusetts officials would have a commitment to public safety, but recent events have sadly proven otherwise. When Governor Maura Healey nominated former prosecutor Vincent DeMore to fill a Massachusetts parole board vacancy, he was given a thumbs down by the council. Councillor Mara Dolan of Concord explained that she cast a vote against DeMore out of fear that he may go too far in ensuring public safety. In progressive circles, it's apparently preferable to release first-degree murderers from prison, as the parole board has done, including a man charged with a mass shooting in Cambridge this spring. He was granted early release by the parole board from an already light sentence for shooting at police officers. The council did approve Healy's next nominee to the parole board, former prosecutor Caitlin O'Leary. Excuse me, but getting a voice for victims and the community shouldn't be a nail-biter. Margaret Abood is running in the September 1st Republican primary for Governor's Council to represent District 7. Abood's website explains that she's running for Massachusetts Governor's Council District 7 because our Commonwealth deserves leadership that is fair, transparent, and deeply committed to justice. There's that word again, justice. It used to mean making criminals pay their debts to society for the harm they caused their victims and their families. The progressive version is just watered-down verbiage. Abood posted on Facebook, "I believe our constitutional freedoms must be protected. I support the Second Amendment, ICE, and safe neighborhoods." Crimmins' website notes that he, I quote, "also understands how judicial decisions affect victims, defendants, families, law enforcement, businesses, and entire communities," end of quote. Abood and Crimmins, two Republican candidates who support justice, safe neighborhoods, and public safety. Victims, families, and communities are top priorities. If elected, they'd be swimming upstream against a progressive current, but they seem determined to give a voice to the people of Massachusetts who've been sidelined for too long. The Boston Herald endorses Francis T. Crimmins, Jr. for Governor's Council, District 2, and Margaret Abood for Governor's Council, District 7. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. And now turning to the opinion page under the headline or the caption, "Taxpayers, accountability is a two-way street, Governor Healy." And this is by Jennifer Nassauer, who is the co-founder of the Pocketbook Project, host of the Political Contessa podcast, and former chair of the Massachusetts GOP. She currently serves as the co-finance chair of the Mike Minogue for Governor campaign. Governor Maura Healey wants Massachusetts residents to know exactly who is responsible for their sky-high energy bills. In a recent letter to legislative negotiators, she called on utilities to drop their legal challenges to customer refunds and accused National Grid, Eversource, and the state's gas companies of seeking steep rate increases while continuing to reward shareholders. "Enough is enough," she wrote, urging lawmakers to pass her energy affordability bill. And you know what? On that point, she's right. Proposed rate increases as high as 55%, growing shareholders' payouts and utility resistance to potentially enormous transmission refunds deserve scrutiny. Massachusetts families cannot keep watching their energy bills climb while utilities explains away every increase. They should have to justify what they charge, explain where the money is going, and stop treating ratepayers like an unlimited source of cash. The problem is that the people Governor Healey is defending are ratepayers and taxpayers, and the state government, speaking so passionately about accountability, has some accounting of its own to do. Take Massachusetts' long-running litigation against ExxonMobil, a case Healey introduced during her time as Attorney General. Taxpayers have every right to know what years of litigation have cost, how the case has been managed, and what the state realistically expects to accomplish. If transparency is the standard Governor Healey wants utilities to meet, surely it should not be unreasonable to ask the same questions of her own administration. These questions become even harder to ignore when the state has struggled to follow its own climate rules. As previously reported, court filings and related litigation revealed that Massachusetts failed for years to comply with its own climate reporting regulation for state vehicle emissions. That is a pretty glaring contradiction. Governor Healey ought to have the same transparency and compliance standards for private companies and her own administration. You cannot demand strict accountability from utilities and then shrug when the state agencies fail to meet standards the Commonwealth created for itself. Funny how that works. But this is a bigger than one lawsuit or one reporting requirement. Governor Healey's entire argument against utilities rests on the idea that powerful institutions providing essential services owe the public transparency. They should tell us how they are spending money, whether they are following the rules, and whether taxpayers and ratepayers are actually getting what they were promised. I agree. I just happen to think government belongs on that list. Michigan recently went so far as to require additional legislative oversight for certain taxpayer-funded lawsuits pursued by its attorney general. Massachusetts does not need to copy that approach, but the principle is worth considering. Litigation conducted in the public's name and funded with public money should not be exempt from public oversight. And that brings us to right back to Governor Healey's energy affordability push. When utilities use the courts to protect their financial interests, the governor calls it legal maneuvering and tells them to stop fighting, drop the lawsuits, and give customers their money. When Massachusetts spends years pursuing costly climate litigation, suddenly prolonged legal maneuvering becomes a perfectly legitimate tool of public policy. Apparently, litigation is only wasteful when the other guy is doing it. Massachusetts should be able to protect the environment while making energy more affordable. Those goals are not mutually exclusive. But families struggling to pay their bills are not helped by a government that spends its time searching for villains while holding itself to different, lower standards. The people across this state need lower costs, a competent administration, and honest accounting from every powerful institution operating with their money. Governor Healey has made it very clear what she expects from the utilities. It is not too much to ask her and her administration to live by the same rules. Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. Clancy reported hearing voice after killings. Closing arguments might happen Monday or Tuesday, by Colleen Cronin. A chaplain who visited with Lindsay Clancy in the hospital told jurors yesterday that Duxbury mom reported hearing a voice that urged her to kill her children and herself. Sheila Cavanaugh, a board-certified chaplain at Brigham and Women's Hospital, said that Clancy told her about the voice on January 31st, 2023, about a week after Clancy strangled her children, Cora, 5, Dawson, 3, and Callan, 8 months, then jumped out her bedroom window, leaving her paralyzed. The chaplain had visited her a few times, starting the day after the killings, and prayed with Clancy while she was intubated. By January 31st, the tubes had been removed from Clancy, and she could speak. Kavanaugh recalled that Clancy's affect was flat. Her emotional state was very neutral. She had heard me for a couple of days. We had prayed together, Kavanaugh said. She said to me, as I held her hand, I quote, "I am so glad that my children are safe," end of quote. Kavanaugh said that she comforted Clancy and spoke theologically, telling her that they were safe now. She alluded to having heard a voice, and the voice, according to Lindsay, if she did not follow the command, neither she nor her children would be safe, Kavanaugh said, testifying the voice was male and it was persistent. The date Clancy reported the voice to Kavanaugh was of note because the prosecution had claimed the first time the defendant reported auditory hallucinations was February 6th to Dr. Paul Zeisel, a psychologist working with the defense. Clancy's attorney, Kevin Reddington, isn't disputing that Clancy did the killings. Instead, he is arguing that his client was suffering from postpartum psychosis and isn't criminally responsible for the deaths. The chaplain said that she met with Clancy more than 200 times from her original visit, including at Brigham and Women's, Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, and Tewksbury Hospital. The voice conversation came up several times during our visits, she said. You wrote very detailed notes, Plymouth Assistant District Attorney Jennifer Sprague said on cross-examination. In all of these notes, you never once said that she had told you that she heard a voice. The chaplain notes are not verbatim, Kavanaugh said. I'm there to bear witness to their suffering. Sprague also asked about Kavanaugh's notes from moments when Clancy appeared to be concerned about never being able to walk again and hopeful when she made physical improvements in February 2023. On redirect, Reddington asked about privileged communications with a chaplain. Because I am not a medically trained clinician, I approached patients in a vortex of trust, she said. There is this understanding that when a patient talks to a chaplain, it's confidential. The chaplain was the only witness to take the stand, and jurors were excused by the late morning. Before proceedings got started, the jurors had been brought in one by one, sworn in, and questioned by the judge. The media couldn't hear what they were being asked. Protesters wearing pink to support Clancy gathered early Thursday morning as the defendant and jurors arrived to the courthouse. After jurors were gone for the day, the judge heard arguments on possible jury instructions. Judge William Sullivan suggested that they use the most recent model instruction from the Supreme Judicial Court for criminal responsibilities in homicides. I quote, criminal responsibility is a legal term, end of quote. The instructions say, a person is not criminally responsible for his conduct if he has a mental disease or defect, and as a result of that mental disease or defect, lacks the substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality or wrongfulness of his conduct, or to confirm his conduct to the requirements of the law. Sprague asked Sullivan to instruct on both first and second degree murder, but to exclude components about intoxication, saying that Clancy only took large quantities of pills after killing the children when she tried to commit suicide. The prosecutor noted that evidence about side effects from Clancy's medications were reported before her trip to McLean Hospital, and those had been out of her system for 3 weeks by the time of the killings. Reddington said that the over-medication they've argued during the trial could constitute as, I quote, involuntary intoxication, end of quote. And those instructions should stay. He also asked that the judge instruct on involuntary manslaughter, which is an unlawful killing unintentionally caused by wanton or reckless conduct, according to Massachusetts law. Sprague said that there was no evidence of that because there was a specific intent to cause the death. Judge Sullivan told the attorneys that he would give them a rough draft of the instructions by tomorrow. The trial will continue Friday morning. Sullivan said that there would be more expert testimony, both from the defense and Commonwealth, and that closing arguments would come on Monday or Tuesday. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. And now we're going to turn to the Biz Smart section of today's Herald, the business section. First, we'll get the Wall Street figures. Dow is down 703.84 to 52,759.29. That's a loss of 1.32%. NASDAQ was down 263.92 to 26,067.17, a loss of 1%. S&P 500 finished at 7641.16, down 66.82, and that was a loss of 0.87%. The euro was up to 1.1677, a increase of 0.0002%, and crude oil was up let's see, 86.83 to 189. And I'm sorry, it was up 189 to 86.83, an increase of 2.23%. Gold was up 26.90 to the total of 4,516.30, an increase of 0.6%. 6 month T-bills came in at 3.91, no increase there. And the last one, 30 years T-bonds, was up 0.06 to 5.25, an increase of 1.18%. And the lead article in the BizSmart section, Bessent's battle with bonds. Treasury Secretary doubled government buying targets. Rates rebounded anyway. And this is from the Associated Press. Dateline Washington. Interest rates rebounded Thursday despite efforts by Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to put a lid on longer-term borrowing costs, a sign Wall Street investors remain worried about burgeoning the government debt, heavy borrowing by tech firms, and the Federal Reserve's commitment to fighting inflation. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, a key benchmark for mortgage rates, rose back to about 4.69% Thursday. That is nearly where it stood early Wednesday before Bessent surprised financial markets by announcing that Treasury would double the size of bond buyback program starting next month to $4 billion per operation from $2 billion. The buybacks are intended to reduce the supply of 10-year to 30-year bonds and boost their prices. Yields on bonds fall when their prices rise. Bessent said Thursday on CNBC that the bond repurchase program could be larger than $4 billion. We have a big toolkit, so we'll see, Bessent said. We believe that the yields don't reflect the underlying fundamentals. Rising bond yields push up borrowing costs for consumers and businesses, and the Trump administration is set to reducing interest rates as a top goal. Home purchases have slumped as mortgage rates have moved higher this year. President Donald Trump has often demanded that the Federal Reserve lower rates, but the ongoing increases are driven primarily by financial markets. The 30-year bond yield rose to 5.23% Thursday, down only slightly from a 19-year high reached Tuesday. Bond markets spooked. Bessent also said that the Trump administration would announce a new effort to reduce the government's budget deficit, possibly by Monday. He argued that the deficit will peak this year, in part because it has been driven higher by tariff refunds, a temporary factor. While the deficit has been huge for years, overall debt topped $40 trillion on Wednesday, a staggering record that arrived just months after the national debt first blew past the $39 trillion mark in April. And the Congressional Budget Office estimated earlier this week that the annual gap between government revenue and spending would top $2 trillion this year, a remarkable number outside of recessions. Gennady Goldberg, head of U.S. rates strategy at TD Securities, said reducing the deficit is mostly up to Congress rather than the Treasury Department. What we are seeing is the market is still a little bit skeptical that Treasury can and will be able to backstop some of these moves, Goldberg said. Another factor pushing yields higher is how much debt big tech companies are raising to build AI data centers. The deluge of bond offerings is giving bond investors more to choose from, which lowers prices for bonds and pushes up their yields. Specter of inflation remains. Inflation also remains a threat because oil prices keep climbing on uncertainty about when the war with Iran will let tankers freely exit the Persian Gulf again. They rose again Thursday after Trump threatened Iraq with the, and these are in capital letters, most crushing economic operation ever taken against any country. The price of Brent crude oil is nearly $94 per barrel, compared to roughly $72 before the start of the war. While Bessent is talking about billions of dollars in bond buybacks, the Treasury market is so large that even purchases at that scale may not have much impact. Analysts at Macquarie, an investment bank, estimate that the U.S. government will need to issue nearly $550 billion in bonds this quarter to finance its operations. History has also shown that government interventions in the bond market have limited effects. While such measures can reduce volatility and provide temporary relief, they have not permanently lowered borrowing costs when fiscal, inflation, or supply dynamics remained unfavorable, according to strategists at UBS Wealth Management, pointing to prior examples from Japan and the United Kingdom. Toddy?
Thanks, Bob. $850,000 statues. Too tall and ask. SJC rules in favor of taxpayers by Flint McColgan. Massachusetts's highest court has ruled that Quincy residents opposing the $850,000 statues of religious figures, who are the patron saints of firefighters and police, on the city public safety building have standing to move forward with their case. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court says that the 12 residents who filed suit over the installation of St. Florian and the Archangel Michael on the facade of the city's new public safety building have standing under what is known as the 10 taxpayer statute. That rule, the SJC wrote in its opinion, issued yesterday, states that not less than 10 taxable inhabitants may petition a court to restrain a city from expending money. The plaintiffs here satisfy these statutory criteria. They include 12 Quincy taxpayers who allege that the city has expended public money to commission and will expend further public monies to transport and install statues depicting Catholic saints on a government building in violation of Article 3. The opinion states, the city's arguments to the contrary are unpersuasive. The court concluded that because the plaintiffs have demonstrated a likelihood of success on the merits to show that the statutes violate Article 3, and the public interest weighs in the plaintiff's favor, the order granting the plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction and denying the defendant's motion to dismiss is affirmed. The ruling comes after the court allowed the city a direct appellate review of a Superior Court decision that halted the project as the lawsuit proceeds. Quincy Mayor Thomas Coach commissioned the 10-foot-tall bronze statues of St. Florian the patron saint of firefighters in Michael, the patron saint of police for the new building in 2023. But the ACLU-backed multi-faith group of Quincy residents opposing the project say this was done with no public input. The SJC found that to be the case, writing in summary that most councilors and the public only learned of the plan to install the statues when a local newspaper reported on the commission on February 8, 2025. The statues, which are projected to cost $850,000 in total, of which the city had already spent at least $761,378.75 on public funds as of January 2025. According to the SJC, were then made a topic of the February 24th, 2025 City Council meeting. Public attendance of that meeting exploded from the four or five residents normally seen to more than 200. That May, city residents filed suit with supporting declarations focusing on the religious attributes of the statues, particularly their significance in the Catholic religion, and stating that the statues send an exclusionary and subordinating message to non-Catholics, and that some plaintiffs feel personally alienated and excluded by the city's proposed installation. Norfolk Superior Judge William Sullivan allowed the suit to move forward and issued the injunction, finding that the plaintiffs have also demonstrated that they are likely to succeed. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. I see we're coming to the end of our time with you today, so I'll read today's horoscope. If today's your birthday, August 21st, happy birthday, and here's your horoscope. You are the crowned creative royal this year. The world makes room for your ideas, your style, and your presence. Doors swing open theatrically, and you walk in good. More highlights. People love picking up the check, gifting you and making you the guest of honor. Work takes on an international flavor. Your personal life is a slice of heaven as domestic work gets distributed evenly and routines allow for greater freedom and flow. Aries and Libra adore you, and your lucky numbers are 8, 32, 17, 27, and 44. And this has been Bob
and Dottie
reading from the August 21st issue of the Boston Herald. We thank you so much for listening and wish you a fantastic Friday.